So I'm going to move straight in an effort to preserve time. We'll just move right into the case presentation and discussion, which will be interactive with our panel. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to be posing you some questions. So back to the case that I presented at the beginning of the session, a 77-year-old male, the history of rectal cancer, treated 2 years prior. This is a healthy patient, asymptomatic, and was treated with chemotherapy, radiation, and an open low anterior resection. Also has had bilateral inguinal hernia repairs. An unremarkable exam, and as you're finishing the visit, he states he's never had a satisfactory erection for intercourse after his LAR 2 years ago. Similarly, after his chemotherapy and radiation, so he's had multiple treatments that can affect his erections. Additional sexual history obtained is that his baseline erectile function prior to the LAR was perfect, with a SHIM score of 25. Currently, his SHIM score is 5. This is indicates severe erectile dysfunction. He's unable to obtain or maintain an erection for intercourse. He's intimate with his wife of 12 years with foreplay 1 to 2 times a month and desires the ability to have intercourse. We've all seen patients like this, and this patient tells you that he's previously failed PDE5 inhibitors as were prescribed by his primary care physician. So what are the key aspects of his history that allow you to think about how to move forward? Dr. Lipschultz, what do you think?
Well, he's got a lot of comorbidities, but they didn't seem to be a problem prior to surgery, although right. He's a diabetic and obese. He did have radical pelvic surgery and immediately had this problem, so one would infer that something happened during surgery. In this case, you know, I would be concerned that it was vascular rather than neuropraxia, because they were down in the pelvis, and this type of surgery is, you know, fairly radical. And I would probably do a duplex and see what his penile blood flow is at this point.
Well, you've certainly answered the first and the second question I have listed there. Third question posed to Dr. Morgenthaler: what further evaluation would be necessary before beginning treatment? Do you agree with Dr. Lipschultz?
I think it's probably, in my mind, this sounds more neurologic than vascular, but both can certainly apply, and I think that a penile vascular study where the men get injected with vasoactive medications that'll help create an erection is worthwhile. And we'd probably do that too, and there's two good things that come from that. One is we actually get some data on how good the arterial inflow and the venous trapping is. And the second is that the man has the experience of what it's, we see whether he gets good erection from the injection. And some of those men, if they get a good erection, we say, okay, that can be a treatment for you. Are you interested in that? And many of them will be. So if the pills don't work, our choices are penile injection therapy, which is part of that test. Dr. Coward showed the MUSE, the little intraurethral suppositories. I don't think those are very successful. I don't do that with my patients anymore unless they ask. Vacuum devices work. They're a little awkward and mechanical, but some men love them. And then finally, we have surgery. So those are our choices mainly. Vacuum device, injections, surgery. If he doesn't want to do injections, and he's 77, so you worry a little bit about an older gentleman, hand-eye coordination and all that stuff, and I didn't catch whether he was obese or not. Maybe he's not an ideal candidate. And for a lot of these patients, the next step, if they really want to do something, is an implant. At 77, I don't know that I want to give him 3 years to see if his nerves recover. And so he's there because he wants treatment now, and I'd probably offer it to him.
Any labs you would get?
Well, you have to get the testosterone, don't you?
All right, so the assessment of morning testosterone is guideline statement number 4, as mentioned by you guys, but I didn't put it in this talk, but penile duplex ultrasound to assess vascular integrity of the penis, that's guideline statement 5. Offer option for consultation with the mental health professional, guideline statement 6. And then lastly, I think it's important to retry PDE5 inhibitors with instructions on use and dose titration, which often wasn't done appropriately in the initial setting. And that's guideline statements 9 and 10. So his morning total testosterone comes back at 185 nanograms per deciliter and hemoglobin A1C of 8.8. So he is treated with testosterone for 6 months and titrates up sildenafil up to a maximum doses without effect. And you guys have already gotten to this, the penile duplex, and that's would be the next step after a short period of treatment with testosterone and titrating up the sildenafil. I didn't show them my slides. They just went ahead and answered all the questions. The duplex shows that he gets a minimal response to the injection, a point already made by Dr. Morgenthaler, which is excellent because we don't have to waste our time prescribing it and having him come back in 3 months. And the ultrasound shows that he's got severe arterial insufficiency and corpora venous occlusive disease, which are likely from his radical pelvic surgery, as mentioned in Dr. Lipschultz's talk. So at this point, how do you approach the discussion of the treatment options? And Dr. Morgenthaler has already gone through some of the options. Dr. Lipschultz, at this point, what would you do?
Well, I mean, at 77, with a 185 treated hypogonadism that did not lead to a good response, I think you have to, and a minimal response to injection therapy, I think the only thing that's left is a penile prosthesis, which is probably the best treatment for this man with arterial disease.
So that's right. So that's what he's considering, is having an inflatable penile prosthesis. Any aspects of his history which would create additional operative considerations?
Well, he's had bilateral hernia repair, so if I'm operating on him, he's getting a two-piece system. Mm-hmm. End of discussion. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to. But the new guidelines now tell us that we could offer him that right at the start.
Right.
Forget about doing injections. Mm-hmm. The only issue in our part of the world here is that many of the insurance carriers want to know that the patient has exhausted all of the more conservative measures. So with this particular guy, I would have injected him right off the bat and then realized it's not really a great option for him. It doesn't work particularly well and so on, and then offered him a two-piece inflatable device.
How do you feel about his diabetic control, and would you operate on him in this setting?
It's a concern, and you obviously want to get his diabetes under the best control possible, and I would certainly try to optimize that preoperatively. And then the other thing is he just needs detailed informed consent that he's got a considerably higher likelihood of a postoperative infection than someone who is not a diabetic.
Yeah, good point.
Another operative consideration could be to just make a counter incision or do an infrapubic IPP, and that way you've got direct visualization of your reservoir space. But I think that you make a good point as well with the two-piece.
Yeah, I worry even for patients who've had any pelvic surgery at all, even if you're doing direct vision, two-piece, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, the only difference between a two-piece and a three-piece is the three-piece system is better in the flaccid state. But other than that, I think cosmetically it's, now I'd be interested in their opinions about that. But
so it's amazing to have two urologists who do this work who agree that a two-piece penile prosthesis is a good choice.
I didn't agree that it was a good choice.
I'm the second. So because at every urology meeting, especially sexual medicine, I think urologists follow this American College of Surgeons. So you know the expression, big surgeon, big incision, right? And of course, everything's gone in the other way. So there's a three-piece device that has a reservoir, for those of you who don't do this work, that goes behind in the retropubic space. So there are different ways to get there. You can make a direct incision just above the pubis. You can, most of us sort of tunnel through and pop through the external inguinal ring. This guy's had mesh surgery. He's also had pelvic surgery before. I don't want to go back there. And so this two-piece device, the reservoir that holds the fluid that you're going to inflate with, actually sits in the deep part of the cylinder itself, which is kind of underneath the scrotum. It's not what we think of as, when people look down at their penis, it's not what they think of as their penis. But the corpora cavernosa go way underneath there. So it's very clever. So it's only two pieces. It's a pump in the scrotum, and it's the cylinders, one that goes in each of the two corpora cavernosa. And it works great, and as Dr. O'Leary says, erectile rigidity, axial rigidity, is just as good as the three pieces. It doesn't transfer as much fluid in and out, and so they've erred on the side of having a better erection, but you can't, because you can't move out as much fluid, the penis is never completely flaccid. So it flops over. It looks pretty good, but it has a certain amount of fullness to it. My patients love it, and it's actually my preferred inflatable device.
Yes.
Yeah, so orgasmic function is the same as it is preoperatively. So if a man can ejaculate or have an orgasm, either one, for example, in a prostate cancer patient, they're not going to ejaculate, but they'll likely still be able to achieve orgasm, sometimes with some difficulty. Sensation similarly would be unaffected. Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
I don't think so. That wouldn't necessarily deter me. The diabetics actually are frequently the more difficult people to implant because they frequently have a lot of corporal fibrosis. But you know, you can get through that. Mm. You just have to chisel away.
You have time for one last. When did you get
to one last question? No
more. I don't think we have. I mean, it's not on our list of things to do for the erectile dysfunction patient. Certainly for the incontinent male, the use of exercises, we usually use a pelvic floor physical therapist to work with them, but I've not heard of using any type of chair.
The guidelines state that this is still experimental and is not part of routine use.
So I don't know anything about the electromotive, but you know what really is here on sort of on the horizon, we've started using this, is the sonic wave or shockwave therapy, low intensity, and also PRP and platelet-rich plasma. And some people think, oh, that's all a bunch of hocus pocus. And I thought so until we got a device to try out. And let me tell you something, it works. Not in everybody. There's nothing that works in everybody. But especially with the guys with milder degrees of ED, the sonic wave treatment is real. There's about 30 publications, most from outside the U.S. It's been around for 10 years. I think it's a real thing. PRP, there's no evidence in for ED, but there is in orthopedic procedures and the dermatologists using it for hair regrowth. Really interesting stuff. Downside is really almost nothing. And so, you know, if you're an evidence-based person, you might say, well, we have to wait, and I'm going to be skeptical. And skeptical is always a good position to be in, but one also has to be open to the possibility that something works, whether or not there is a large randomized controlled study of 5 years behind it. So you have to start somewhere, and I would say that the early evidence is this stuff is exciting, and it's helpful for many men. No, not ultrasound. So it's a sonic wave or a low-intensity shock wave. And the second thing, PRP, is platelet-rich plasma, where they take blood from your own blood, centrifuged until you get an enriched fraction that's got the platelets. You add some calcium to activate it, and the platelets are full of growth factors. And so that gets injected into the tissues, in this case, for the corpora cavernosa.
Okay, well, thank you all very much.